Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. Today we'll be talking about climate change and the displacement of people and communities. Over the course of history, displacement and migration has happened for all kinds of reasons, as a response to economic upheaval, armed conflict, and of course, natural disasters. Think of the tens of thousands of Americans who have been leaving Puerto Rico for the mainland of the United States over the last few months. As it turns out, a growing number of experts believe that the impacts of climate change will spur a new era of human displacement and migration within the United States and abroad. There are ways to address that challenge, but first, we have to connect the dots. Our show today has two parts. First, I'll be talking with Maxine Burkett, a legal expert in climate migration. Second, we'll hear a set of many interviews that I conducted recently with participants of the Conference on Climate Change Migration, organized by the IBS Center for Climate Physics and held in Busan, South Korea. Up first is Professor Maxine Burkett of the University of Hawaii Law School. She's a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a member scholar of the Center for Progressive Reform. Maxine is joining us from her home in Honolulu, Hawaii. Maxine, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be talking with you virtually.
I have a question that I want to ask, because in the press, when we read about climate change, there's been a phrase, climate refugees, that has come up over and over again. Sometimes it's describing people in the United States who might be leaving an area that is flooded or threatened by climate change. In other contexts, we're talking about people who might be in small island nations like Palau or the Maldives, also worried about sea level rise. I know that in your own writing, you tend to use the word climate displaced persons. Who are climate displaced persons, and why are their challenges important for us to understand?
Yeah, climate displaced persons are those that are on the move as a result of some kind of climate-related event that has occurred in their home location, wherever they're living currently. And what we know is that the term climate refugee is very evocative because it suggests that people are on the move, and it is true that, in fact, the circumstances of movement are in some cases as dire as those that we understand for political refugees, for example. But legally, there isn't a hook, if you will. There isn't a legal stipulation. There aren't a set of legal instruments that effectively respond to the circumstances of those that are moving because of climate-induced events. And so we sort of do a disservice to those that are currently political refugees and those that have this very unique circumstance when we don't describe them in the way that's legally afforded and legally appropriate. So climate-displaced persons, again, a growing number of people who will move internally and cross-border as a result of some sort of climate impact that is either acute, sudden onset, or slower events like desertification, high temperatures, sea level rise, constant inundation because of flooding events.
I noticed one study where the UN estimates that by 2050, climate change may displace as many as 200 million people in the world. I mean, obviously, that sounds like a huge number. And I'm wondering what kinds of legal instruments or legal agreements do we have on hand to address a problem like that?
Yeah, I just to address the issue of the numbers first, and then talking about the difficulty that the law and people that work in this area find themselves in, is that, you know, there is an incredible range that has been estimated for people on the move. And I've seen numbers as low as 25 million, still a large number, but compared to the 1 billion or 2 billion most recently that was estimated in a study that came out this past fall, we know that this could be a massive humanitarian and management problem across countries, within and across countries, and we have no real sense of scope. And in fact, numbers like 200 million by 2050 say something about who might be moving at that time or who might have moved and completed the move. Or we're also not really even sure of whether or not we're talking about those that are resettled or those that are actually in that moment in the process of moving.
Well, let me ask you about the international effects first. So this, I guess, would be the cross-border types of migration or displacement. Person can't legally claim to be a climate refugee, right, in the sense of having any kinds of entitlements under international agreements. Can you walk us through that? Why is that? That is, why don't we have a legal status of climate refugee? And I guess the next question would be, should we have something like that?
That's a great question, and I'll answer it in the first part in three ways. What is the current legal infrastructure internationally? We have a refugee convention, and the refugee convention has a very specific definition of what it means to be a refugee, and it's in that case, it's about people that are moving as a result of some kind of persecution that's happening at the hands of their government and because of their membership in a certain class, whether it's race, religion, nationality. There are a whole host of categories that you could be identify yourself as a part of, and the need to move is an urgent one because of some kind of experience or threat of persecution. And with that comes a whole suite of protections and obligations that kick in by the nations that have signed on to the Refugee Convention in order to meet your rights to a whole host of other sets of human rights that we all hold dear. The problem, of course, is that we don't have, in the circumstances of climate change, most often, those triggers. Membership of a certain class, urgency, persecution. It's particularly persecution at the hands of your government. In some respects, this whole phenomenon of climate migration has been marked by leaders that are actually hoping to assist their citizens in the process of moving. That's certainly true in the Pacific, where we see a number of Pacific Island nations being able to, in a very compelling and persuasive way, describe their desire to assist their citizens in the move that they anticipate in their foreseeable future. So we have this difficulty of not having an appropriate definition that encompasses the circumstances of climate-induced migration. There are circumstances, though, where you might be able to appeal to the refugee definition because of a climate induced event. So in some respects, we see the sort of fingerprints of climate change in the Syrian refugee crisis. Very complicated, absolutely important that we don't absolve political leaders who have made terrible choices and are indeed persecuting their citizens irrespective of the environmental conditions that that exist. But we do see that there are circumstances, if we take Syria as a cautionary tale, there are circumstances in which environmental stressors can actually introduce circumstances that then produce a refugee crisis itself. So if a multi-year drought pushes a number of otherwise agricultural a number of farmers, for example, into urban areas, and we see this sort of cascading set of events that produce a refugee crisis that has very much been predominant in the political realities of Europe, we can see that there is a link between climate and refugee, but it's really attenuated, and then becomes more of a political refugee circumstance understood in the traditional way in the traditional understanding of what the Refugee Convention is meant to address. The last thing I'll say about the refugee definition is that there are no specific appeals under the international existing international law and treaties. However, we see New Zealand, for example, being quite intrepid in their willingness to engage with the possibility of a climate refugee as a very real phenomenon. And in fact, we see they have a proposal under their new administration that is looking at establishing a climate refugee visa. And all of the parameters and the specifics of that, I think, are in progress. But I think that process of actually making the decision to explore a climate refugee visa status suggests that we are at the point where we find it necessary and, in fact, helpful for countries individually or in concert to make decisions about how we manage this.
Oh, now that's interesting. So in the example of New Zealand, is Is that a situation in which the New Zealand government is negotiating a status with other nations, or is this something that they might just offer universally?
Yeah, my understanding is that it is a kind of unilateral decision making that they're engaging in, and this would be, you know, one of potentially a whole set of regimes that they have in terms of labor migration and other ways in which you might be able to access New Zealand, whether it's to be with your family that is already there, or to participate in existing labor markets. This is, my understanding, a very standalone approach to engaging the very real political circumstances of their neighbors. And it's perhaps no surprise that New Zealand, proximate to the South Pacific and the number of Pacific Islanders that are having to move, and hosting a significant Pacific Islands population, of course, themselves being quite a Pacific-oriented country with their Maori citizens, they've been much more progressive in all sorts of approaches to thinking about the climate, the impacts of climate change on the region.
It would seem to me that one issue, obviously, is for members of a country who might be crossing borders to be able to enter a different country. That's a legal problem that we've just discussed. But there seem to be huge financial implications to this, too, right? I mean, it's expensive for people to move individually. It's even more expensive for communities to uproot and decide to go somewhere else. What are the kinds of funds that we have available internationally to help with this, and are they sufficient?
I can answer the second question first, very briefly. They're not sufficient.
I could have figured that. All right.
I mean, and that's true for climate change across the board. And I think what will be important to consider is that climate change, both the process of mitigation and adaptation, are under-resourced, and specifically adaptation efforts, the efforts that will allow for communities to build their resilience in response to climate impacts, is woefully underfunded.
I want to ask you about the internally displaced populations that you mentioned earlier. And I thought that maybe this would be a good time to move our discussion to the United States, because although a lot of people don't realize that there is an issue with the potential for populations being displaced within the United States. And in fact, a researcher that we know, Matt Hauer at the University of Georgia, has speculated that by 2100, we may see as many as 13 million people displaced by sea level rise just in the United States, mainly, of course, from population centers that are really close to the coast. What do you see as the major issues in terms of climate displacement in the United States? Is it, again, problems with legal infrastructure and financial resources? Does it come down to that again?
That's definitely at play, absolutely. I think, you know, we are seeing climate-induced migration impact the United States. We're not immune to it. And we also have it in the popular imagination with respect to, again, like you mentioned, the climate refugees that were noted during Katrina and Harvey and Maria. But in fact, some of the impacts in the U.S. that are the most have been the most impactful over time, and perhaps not as immediately understood, are the impacts that are slower onset. So in Alaska, for example, we have had almost a generation of efforts to get ahead of what is essentially a crumbling infrastructure and crumbling communities and cultures as a result, because of the incredible heat increase that we're seeing in the Arctic region that's impacting people's livelihoods, their cultural subsistence life ways, literally their roads and buildings and schools. And so there have been years of efforts to move those communities to places that are safer for them as the sea ice in particular melts and as storms increase. So we have these slower onset events in the U.S. that are also happening that don't capture the imagination as readily, but are still as devastating and create an upheaval and a management problem that we have been hobbling along with. Louisiana now has seen in the coastal regions in the Delta and with the Île-de-Jean-Charles in particular the opportunity both to receive funding from the federal government for some early efforts at migration relocation. But it also has allowed for there to be another, a more nuanced conversation about migration in the U.S. that's on the slow onset piece. But that particular relocation reveals some of the difficulties that we have in planning around this in the U.S. The funding is insufficient. There are a number of actors at all sorts of scales that have to coordinate and have a hard time with that. So, for example, whether it's everyone from the tribal leadership to the state government to the federal government that's funding, there are coordination issues that make for a less than seamless process of determining when to go, who can go, and where to go, and how to reestablish communities in those spaces.
Is there an example of a successful relocation?
We have seen resilient stories in the Pacific Northwest, the Quinault tribe in particular, in which relocation was sort of less ceremonious in that it was done understanding that they were kind of caught between the sort of sea level rise and flooding and melting, and they had to move. And they coordinated with themselves, maintained a fair degree of autonomy, and have been cited by a number of even federal entities as providing examples of how you can maintain resilience through relocation. So we've had different kinds of stories of that. And again, we see it happening in the U.S., and I think will continue to happen in more or less coordinated ways.
And we should say that you and I both participated in writing a study with our CPR policy analyst, David Flores. We wrote a report that was released last year called Reaching Higher Ground, which is about several communities that we identified in the United States that were planning relocation efforts in response to climate change. And those communities, all of which were tribal, represented communities up in Alaska, on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State, and of course down on Île-de-Jean-Charles, as you pointed out, in Louisiana. In time, I suppose that the Congress is going to have to think about a better approach to this issue as the problem becomes more acute, particularly as larger population centers begin to experience the problems that smaller Alaska Native villages, for instance, are now experiencing. Maxine, if you could wave a wand and create a bill and a Congress that was focused on climate displacement in the United States, what would a bill like that look like?
We have governance challenges. There's a lack of a governing agency with a mandate or funding for relocation. There's no real institutional framework to determine when relocation is necessary, to determine the suitability of host communities. This kind of coordination will be a real advantage as we continue to think about the communities that are going to be relocated. There was, at the close of the Obama administration, a proposal for an interagency task force that would actually be a coordinating body to do just this. And the initial question, of course, would be, well, what is the problem that we're dealing with? What's the scope? And what is the best management infrastructure? And so I think we would need for Congress to consider that initial step of scoping. Well, relatively rapidly. We don't have time to just study this. We actually have to act on it. But then to actually think about what is the appropriate governing infrastructure, an agency may be the best way to do that, or some way for the federal government to serve as a coordinating body to allow for cross-sector, departmental, state-level organization and conversation. Also, of course, funding will be important to understand to better support the communities as they understand their vulnerabilities and what the best possible outcome might be. Right now, we could look at something like the Denali Commission, which has worked over years in Alaska as a body that has had a coordinating function that has recognized as much as it could the autonomy of the communities that are moving and has had as a commission the flexibility that the flexibility to combine and transfer different sources of funds and to work again with various communities to at least scope out the best possible response. It's not been executed with perfection, but these are the kinds of flexible instruments we could do in the interim while we find a more longstanding governing body that can do the work.
Maxine, thanks so much for our conversation today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots. That was my interview with Maxine Burkett, a professor of law at the University of Hawaii and a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's also a member scholar of the Center for Progressive Reform. Up next, we'll hear a set of mini interviews that I had recently with participants of the Conference on Climate Change Migration, organized by the IBS Center for Climate Physics, held in Busan, South Korea. We'll hear that after this short break.
This is Brian Gumm, the Communications Director at the Center for Progressive Reform. You're listening to Rob Virchik on Connect the Dots. Rob is one of 60 member scholars here at the Center for Progressive Reform with expertise in environmental health, safety, natural resources, and energy policy. To tap into this wealth of knowledge, visit www.progressivereform.org.
Two things I really love about academics. One is working with students who are always passionate and curious about the environmental issues that they are working on. And the second is that if you play it right, you get to go to some conferences with some very interesting people in some interesting parts of the world. Last December in 2017, I was invited to go to a climate change migration conference that was organized by the IBS Center for Climate Physics and held in Busan, South Korea. For people who attend these kinds of academic conferences, it's common to say that no matter how good the presentations and slide decks are, some of the best things, most interesting things that you learn come from individual discussions you have in the hallway. So during this trip to South Korea, instead of bringing my camera, I brought my audio recorder. And I buttonholed a few people that I thought you might like to hear from. Now, this was buttonholing, not stalking. Everybody was very, very nice. And we were out by the coffee bar or in the banquet hall or in one case by a piano. You'll hear a piano. And I asked these folks just two questions. One question was, in your line of work, what is it about climate that concerns you the most? And the second question was, are there any glimmers of hope on the horizon? Let's start with the challenges first. Here's Mark Thomas, professor of evolutionary genetics at University College at London.
Well, the biggest challenge, I think, and it's just the elephant in the room, is the whole principle of the tragedy of the commons. The simple fact is that people won't all work together to change something globally if there's going to be significant gains by not acting as one of the group. And so I think that is the elephant in the room. I don't see a obvious solution for it. I mean, I think it's evidenced already that both large and small countries are pulling out of various climate agreements and they're just following the standard rules of the tragedy of the commons. So, you know, that's a problem.
Here's Peter Domenical, a paleoclimatologist at Lamont Dougherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University.
So for climate adaptation, I think the biggest challenge is to find a way to make this economically viable. You know, there's a lot of discussion about equity. There's a lot of discussion about doing enough that will move the needle on carbon. But in my opinion, I think the way that this has to begin is to make it economically viable and actually to incentivize to reward actions that will reduce carbon in the atmosphere.
And here's David Battisti, an atmospheric scientist at the University of Washington at Seattle.
My number one concern about adaptation is to try to create new varieties so that they thrive under higher temperatures. Now, this has been something that the international crop research community has been working on since 1970s, and they've made no progress, zero progress. Heat is a very complex trait to breed for, and so in particular, one center that's been focused on this is the Center for wheat and maize production in Mexico City, international research program for creating new varieties. They've been working on this problem. They've made no progress. I mean, there's always been, oh, we have maybe a promising avenue here, promising avenue here, but there's been no progress.
Here's Kazuki Saito. He's a physical climatologist at Japan Agency for Science and Technology.
Well, one thing is that due to the climate change or recent global warming, so the infrastructure is being damaged, like thawing of permafrost or deepening the active layer thickness make the gas pipelines or streets, railroad, and also buildings have a great impact on that from that. So the how to deal with these changes induced by the global warming is the greatest challenge I see, I mean, in my field.
Then I met Andrea Simonelli, Assistant Professor of Human Security at Virginia Commonwealth University. I asked her what the biggest problem was.
It's political will.
Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. The political will to really do what needs to be done. And what that means is not really being able to follow the same economic trends and the economic backers that back politicians to keep their power structure, essentially guide where we've been going the last 30 years over the cliff into the abyss.
Do we need to change our politics in the United States to change the economic incentives?
Well, it would be a big difference if we could get the money out of politics, although I don't see that happening overnight. It's really about having the type of representatives that really care about being responsive to the people, because most people who are in vulnerable areas have already been vocal about their needs. It's right. About actually being responsive to them.
Okay, so now you're ready for the hopeful part. Here you go.
Are there any rays of hope? Anything that makes you slightly optimistic about
it? Oh, yeah, I am optimistic in a number of ways, a number of reasons. So, firstly, I think that there will be economically efficient alternatives to fossil fuels for energy, not just for energy production, but also for energy storage, so hydrogen fuel cells and so on. I think the important thing is not to encourage people to use them because they're the right things to use, because only a small minority will do that. I think what we should need to do is invest in making them very economically competitive. And that will ultimately drive down the value of fossil fuels for energy use. Of course, fossil fuels will have other hydrocarbons will still have other uses in, for example, production of plastics and various chemicals. And I think that will carry on. But on the other hand, you know, plastics, they can be a problem for pollution, but at least they lock up carbon.
Do you see any rays of hope?
I do, actually. Along the same lines, I think that there was this quiet revolution that happened just a few years ago, which is the cost of producing an electron of electricity through renewable finally became cheaper than fossil fuels just a few years ago, and that's led to this explosion of deployment in renewable energies. And so I see that as the genie is being let out of the bottle, the renewable energy genie is being let out of the bottle. And so, I think the ray of hope there is that there's an economic backwind, if you will, to doing the right thing.
If I think back even 5 years ago and I think, like, the odds of us not at least doubling and probably tripling carbon dioxide before the end of this century are basically zero. Today, I don't say that anymore. Actually, I think the pace that renewables have come down in price and have been adopted around the world is really astonishing. I mean, every year I teach my one course in climate, and I have to update those slides, and they've changed, from one year to the next, the amount of solar has gone up by a factor of seven. I mean, seven, they're still small numbers, but it's going at such a rapid pace that if we keep investing in developing renewables, and we develop a battery technology that solves this problem of, when the sun goes down, there's no solar, and when the wind stops, there's no wind. If we develop those batteries to store massive amounts of electricity, fossil fuels are going to be ancient history. Nobody's going to want to use them.
Are there any rays of hope? What gives you hope when you think about adapting to climate change?
Well, the multitude of mayors across the country that have started to see the need in their cities to start to make change.
So there you go, a multitude of mayors. That was Mark Thomas at the University College, Peter Domenico at Columbia, David Battisti at the UW, and Andrea Simonelli at Virginia Commonwealth University. I'm going to leave the last word for Maxine Burkett, our guest from the first part of the program. Maxine was also a participant at the Climate Migration Conference in South Korea and probably had something to do with getting me invited, which I'm very thankful for. And so I asked Maxine what ray of hope she sees.
So my ray of hope, I think, is that I think we all have, as a law professor, I'm working with law students on a daily basis, and I think that the fact that we have the privilege of having an education and a capacity to actually do something about it is one that comes with a responsibility as well. And as young folks that are so much better prepared in some ways for the future they're facing, they're, I think, embracing both the privilege and the responsibility of acting with the degree that they have, the experience that they'll gain, and their vision for a different kind of future understanding the climate constraints. So that's very hopeful for me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. My guest today was Maxine Burkett of the University of Hawaii. We also heard short interviews from participants at the Conference on Climate Change and Human Migration, organized by the IBS Center for Climate Physics and held in Busan, South Korea. Our music was provided today by Lobo Loco and Pure Greece.
You've been listening to Connect the Dots podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center helping to build healthy communities, safe workplaces, and a more resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website, www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.